This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Virginia is in a leadership crisis. The week began with Governor Ralph Northam answering for a racist photo in his medical school yearbook. But the list of embattled Virginia politicians is longer now, as is the list of people considering a run for president. And also, President Trump awaits word from Congress on his border wall days after delivering one of the longest State of the Union addresses in history. There's a lot to discuss on this Friday news roundup, and joining us in studio is NPR's lead digital political reporter, Jessica Taylor. Jessica, welcome back to the roundup.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
We're also glad to welcome two new guests on the roundup today. James Antle is the editor-in-chief of the American Conservative magazine. Jim, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
And Mark Fisher is a senior editor at the Washington Post. Good to have you, Mark.
Good to be here.
Let's begin in Virginia. And it's kind of hard to overstate what a busy week this has been for Virginia. First, on Friday, last Friday, the news focused on Governor Ralph Northam.
The Democratic governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam, is now apologizing for a photograph of two people, one in blackface and one in a KKK hood, on his 1984 medical school yearbook page.
Then on Sunday, it turned to the lieutenant governor, Justin Fairfax.
A political crisis is swirling around now, not just Virginia's governor, but now the lieutenant governor, who faces an uncorroborated assault allegation dating back to 2004.
And then on Wednesday, it was Virginia's attorney general, Mark Herring.
Breaking news about another high-ranking statewide official who finds himself embroiled in a blackface photo controversy. Hans Nichols is standing by for us there in Richmond with the very latest. Hans, what in the world is happening in the Commonwealth?
Good question. What in the world is happening? The top three government officials in the state of Virginia could all or some resign. Last week during the Friday News Roundup, we weren't talking about Virginia at all. And Jessica Taylor, now we're talking about all three of these officials facing some extreme scandals. What's going on? What's underlying all of this?
I think it's almost at this point sort of a mutually assured destruction in a way. Sort of if one of them goes, who goes next or something. So maybe by these scandals sort of trickling out this week, it certainly seems like there is a possibly better than 50-50 chance that it seemed like Northam was going to be gone by this week. I mean, he probably had the worst response of any of them to this crisis, because he came out on Friday initially saying, I was in this photo, admitting it, apologizing. And then on Saturday, he held just a completely bizarre and off the rails press conference saying, no, I wasn't in it, but I did actually wear blackface this one time. It was just a really weird press conference and did him no good.
Let me play a quick clip from that press conference, and then I'll let you finish your thought. Here's part of what Governor Northam said.
Michael Jackson, excuse me. That's why I had Pam with me. I had the shoes, I had a glove, and I used just a little bit of shoe polish to put under my or on my cheeks. And the reason I used a very little bit is because I don't know if anybody's ever tried that, but you cannot get shoe polish off.
Part of the press conference with Governor Northam. Jessica?
Yeah, and after that, a reporter asked him if he could still moonwalk, and he seemed like he was considering it until his wife stopped him. So that was how off the rails this press conference was. Then it came out, the sexual assault allegation against the lieutenant governor, Justin Fairfax, who was seen as a rising star in the party, and many people wanted Northam to step aside because he is this rising African-American politician. But then this came out, and then when it seemed like things couldn't get any worse, the next day it came out that the Attorney General, Mark Herring, who seemed like he was sort of waiting in the wings of all of this, said that he had worn blackface at one point, too. So it's sort of, Herring had, I think, the best response of all of them. He came out, he met with the Black Caucus, he put out a very detailed statement. And, you know, and then I think Fairfax's, Democrats are, I think, in a hard position here because they have been so quick to condemn other people when they've been accused of sexual assault or sexual harassment, Al Franken, for instance. And we've seen a lot of people really being silent on him and really being pressed. So it's, who knows what's going to happen in Virginia, but it is certainly a mess, is the understatement.
Mark Fisher, who are the winners and losers if one of these three lawmakers resigns? Does anyone stand to gain or lose from any particular outcomes?
Look, the Democrats stand to lose because one, two, or three of their main political leaders in Virginia are possibly going to fall. If you got to the fourth in succession for governor in Virginia, you would come to the Republican leaders of the legislature. But even there, there are going to be issues, because there's this moment of inspection now where anyone who has a yearbook that might have someone in blackface in it is going to face this same kind of crisis. What we have here is really the social justice imperative of Me Too coming smack up against the hyper inspection of anybody being able to look into someone's past online. And we haven't come to terms yet with what that means. High school yearbooks used to be things that got dusty in people's attics. Now they're online and everyone can inspect them. And so really every politician is at risk here, and that's why you're seeing almost a kind of bipartisanship about this.
James Antle, it's also worth noting that Virginia's state government is split by a hair. I mean, that last seat in the last election, they literally kind of decided by lottery. They drew lots. I wonder what your take is on what this means for Republicans in Virginia, who I'm sure would love to have, you know, power of the state government back again, but the circumstances are super touchy.
Well, certainly to have won your election by having your name picked out of a bowl or picked out of a hat doesn't give you a lot of legitimacy if you're going to be taking power under this set of circumstances. I think Republicans have sort of been on the downswing in Virginia for some time. And under Donald Trump, it's really accentuated a problem that Virginia Republicans have had dating back to George W. Bush, in that the more conservative parts of the state really need to be motivated by very conservative candidates. Those conservative candidates don't do particularly well in Northern Virginia and seem to be doing worse and worse in Northern Virginia all the time.
We should be clear, Northern Virginia is much more politically aligned with Washington, D.C., which is solid, solid blue, compared to Southern Virginia, which is much more conservative.
A lot of government employees, the Washington, D.C. suburbs. You have to be able to lose Northern Virginia not so badly in order to win statewide. And that's been a very delicate balance for Virginia Republicans. So if this is something that demoralizes some of these suburban Democrats, some of these exurban Democrats in the northern part of the state, that could help Republicans sneak into some offices. There's also just the dilemma of, now you have three statewide elected officials who would be a liability to any Democrat campaigning in a down ballot race. So it's going to be touchy if they come and appear with you, make campaign appearances with you. It's going to be touchy whether you want to accept any of their money. Maybe you don't want them appearing with you, and maybe you don't want their money. Now, you still do have Tim Kaine and Mark Warner, so it's not that they're completely out of luck, but this is a state that had been moving away from being a swing state. It had gone red, became purple. Now it's really moving towards being a solid, more of a solid blue. Does this, at least for a cycle or two, make it a little purpler again? Possibly.
Lots of comments about the Virginia story, but before we get to those, Jessica, you wanted to jump back in.
Yeah, I mean, this is a problem for Democrats this year because they hold off-year elections. And they did very well in 2017 when Northam and Fairfax and Herring were all elected, and they picked up way more seats in the House of Delegates than they really thought they were going to. So there was a solid chance this coming year they were looking to flip the state Senate. So this is not just something that maybe voters will have thought about in 2020. I mean, this is a problem that is rapidly approaching for them, and it's one big reason why, you know, you saw, I think, a lot of Democrats, state Democrats, really sort of call for Northam to resign, and then once everything other drip drip, they're really not sure what to do. So it's a nightmare scenario for them, much closer than November 2020. It's November 2019 they're worried about.
Let me get to some of your comments now. Julie in Burke, Virginia emailed, how many politicians, Democratic or Republican, particularly across the South, will be found to have done the same or similar disgraceful things? What started out as an attempt by a conservative source to harm Northam and Democrats in Virginia generally may turn out to be a bomb for conservative politicians as well. Charles is in Port Charlotte, Florida, and Charles writes, a reminder that here in Florida, we recently had a blackface scandal as well. To Governor DeSantis' credit, he put that particular fellow into an airlock and blasted him into deep space in like 5 minutes. Virginia is now going into its second week with three officials. Mark, I do take the point that Charles is making. Charles is referring to actually two people. There was a Florida state senator, state representative named Anthony Sabatini. Some of his high school yearbook pictures surfaced recently, and he commented on that to the Orlando Sentinel. Last month, Florida's Secretary of State Michael Erdl resigned after pictures of him surfaced wearing blackface, and it said that he was dressing as a Hurricane Katrina victim. And the newly elected governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, bounced him from Florida's cabinet right away.
It's quite remarkable. I mean, in 2019, we think of blackface as something that is clearly socially unacceptable. And yet, if you look back just a couple of decades ago, high school and college yearbooks are chock-a-block with pictures of kids in blackface.
Well, you can look a few months ago, and there are Instagram feeds that are chock-a-block with white kids wearing blackface.
Absolutely. And The Economist has a poll out today saying that 17% of Americans still believe it is acceptable for a white person to wear blackface makeup. So this is not something that is a complete consensus across the country. And a lot of people are still looking at Governor Northam's situation and saying, what did he do wrong?
This week, the nation lost two legends, one from sports, the other from politics. Baseball Hall of Famer Frank Robinson was the only man to be an MVP in the National and American Leagues. He played for five teams over 21 seasons, and he was Major League Baseball's first African-American manager. Frank Robinson died this week. He lived to be 83. Also, Democratic Representative John Dingell of Michigan was the longest-serving member of Congress ever, from Eisenhower to Obama. In his 60 years as a lawmaker, Dingell was key in passing the Clean Air and Water Acts, Medicare, the Endangered Species Act, and the Civil Rights Act. John Dingell lived to be 92. Before we move on from Virginia, let me get to a few more comments on that. And it seems like those of y'all listening are pretty evenly split between forgiving and forgetting and off with their heads. Let me read a few more comments. Jose writes, "Why are we so surprised? Racists do not disappear. They transform and they blend in. Racism is ingrained in our culture and history. On the other hand, we have to move on. Let us admit that the racists that were here 40 years ago are still here. We have to live with them, and we have to give them a second chance. Let us move on." One listener who asked us not to use her name wrote, "I am white and grew up in a very white state in the Northeast. I am embarrassed to say that I just recently learned about blackface and never remember learning about this in high school back in the 80s. When I talk to others with a similar background as me, they too were oblivious to this. Although I never dressed in blackface, I now know that it is offensive." Jessica Taylor, I am amazed in a way, but not surprised at all, that this is the first time that some Americans are engaging with this. I mean, I was on MTP Daily on MSNBC earlier this week, just kind of doing an explainer. I was amazed how many tweets from people I got, like, thank you for finally explaining this to me.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a sordid past dating back to minstrel shows and certainly everything like that. But, you know, I think a lot of it depends on what region in the country you grew up in. I mean, I grew up in the South, and I am not surprised at all that some of this stuff is coming up, and I'm not sure that blackface was ever explained to me, but I mean, Confederate flags, different things were prevalent in the area I grew up in, and I remember fraternities getting in trouble for dressing up as Confederate soldiers when I was in college, which was just last decade. So I think none of this is a surprise, but I think also the difference, I think, to Northam's, why I think maybe it shocked more people, was this wasn't from his high school days. This wasn't from his college days. This was the last year he was in medical school. So he was in his mid-20s. He was getting ready to become a doctor, was seeing patients and things too. So I think that's another reason there was a little bit of a difference between Herring said his happened when he was 19. So this wasn't just sort of a youthful indiscretion. He was becoming a medical doctor.
Mark?
That's absolutely right. I mean, he was 25, and this is he admitted to another incident that also took place when he should have known better. But I don't think it's really quite a North-South issue. I think this is really quite universal across the country. And what you can see in high school and college yearbooks, college parties, even to this day, fraternity parties, where blackface is something that does happen. And it's not a question of class. It's not a question of geography. It's a question of ingrained attitudes in the society. But on the other hand, I think one of the reasons Northam is still there and could even survive this scandal is because the country is still grappling with this idea of, do we hold people responsible for what they were when they were 25 or 16, or do we look at the whole course of a lifetime? And Ralph Northam is someone who has devoted himself to racial reconciliation. He attends a majority black church and has for decades. And so this is someone who has made race an important part of who he is in ways that many of his supporters find constructive.
I'm glad you raised the point of redemption, Mark, because James, I wanted to ask you about that as well, particularly as it relates to the kind of path forward. A number of our listeners raised redemption as a key point. Constance writes, "Can we please stop throwing away politicians because of stupid things they did when they were much younger? It's amazing that a lifetime of service evidently counts for nothing if someone discovers that they did some small, regrettable thing in their youth." And Philip from Pittsburgh writes, "With regard to the scandals in Virginia, we need to leave room for redemption. The leadership there should use this situation to show how they've changed, as they claim, and advance ideas to heal racial division there in Virginia." James?
Well, it does raise that question, because Northam's depictions, the racist depictions in his yearbook, do not reflect what he has done publicly in three plus decades as a leader in his community and then later as a public servant. So the case for redemption and forgiveness for him is stronger than in perhaps some other cases. However, I go back to the whole affair with Trent Lott and Strom Thurmond. And my view was that Lott was not attempting to say we should have had the States' Rights Party win the 1948 election. He was paying a compliment to an old man on his 100th birthday. However, I think in the aftermath of that, he completely mishandled the response. And I think that if you want to lead a major political party in this century, you have to be able to muster a more convincing disavowal of racial segregation than Trent Lott did in that context. And I sort of see the same thing with Ralph Northam right now. I thought that his contradictory responses to even whether he was in the picture, his deciding that maybe he was going to moonwalk at the press conference, his sort of bizarre, he should have been able to handle this in a way that reassures people that that's not who he is, and that he is taking this more seriously than just a matter of his personal political survival.
I know we got to move on to some other stories. We may come back to a few of your comments on this. If we do have time, we'll definitely make time to talk about this issue as the story continues to develop. Fascinating to see how many different views there are on blackface. If I may speak as your close black friend who's willing to talk to you about these things, I strongly recommend against you ever using blackface unless you can own the consequences of wearing blackface. When you are ready to own the consequences of it, go right ahead. Until then, I wouldn't. I'm just saying. Let's move on. Let's talk about immigration. There was some news on immigration this week, including a musical story.
How much money you got? A lot. How many problems you got? A lot. How many people done doubted you? A lot. Left you out to rot? A lot. How many pray that you flaunt? A lot. How many lawyers you got? A lot. How many times you got shot? A lot. How many you shot? A lot.
That's an Atlanta-based rapper named 21 Savage. He was detained by ICE this week in a move that stunned fans and raised questions over who ICE targets for deportation. ICE claims that he is an unlawful national of the UK who overstayed his visa. 21 Savage was born in the UK. He moved to the US when he was 7. His 3 children are American citizens. Jessica, what does this say about ICE enforcement more broadly? We hear a lot about undocumented immigrants at our borders. A vast majority of people in the country illegally are folks who overstayed their visas, but I think this caught a lot of people by surprise.
Yeah, this was surprising. I mean, to be honest, I never even heard of this rapper before this. But, you know, that I think it just shows that they're everywhere. They're looking into all of these. They are taking a much more aggressive approach under this administration. And this is someone far more high profile that was ensnared by this, that sort of doesn't fit the typical profile that we feel like ICE is going after. But, you know, I think that he has some advantages that, you know, other undocumented people may not have. You know, Jay-Z has said that he's going to raise a legal defense fund for him. You know, he's making this argument. He has fans across the country. So, you know, he could possibly, you know, find a way to stay in the country thanks to those things that, you know, other people that are detained and held may not have.
Let's talk about Jeff Bezos, the founder and CEO of Amazon. He has hit back at the National Enquirer. The tabloid published an expose on an extramarital affair between Bezos and Lauren Sanchez, who's a former TV anchor. Surprisingly, he made a Medium blog post yesterday in which Bezos detailed how the parent company of the National Enquirer, American Media Incorporated, threatened to release his private photos, Bezos' photos, if he did not stop an investigation into how AMI obtained his personal messages with Lauren Sanchez. Bezos also owns The Washington Post. So, AMI got Bezos' photos, messages with Lauren Sanchez. Bezos investigated that. AMI tells Bezos, you knock that off, or we are going to release private photos of you. Mark Fisher, what's going on here?
Well, this is a power play. This is a confrontation between the richest man in the world and the biggest purveyor of tabloid gossip in the world. And potentially it involves the President of the United States and at least some of his most avid supporters. So it's a complex story. And this is not the first attempt that the National Enquirer has made to silence this story. They had tried through various means, threat letters, lawyers' appeals, negotiations to stop previous news coverage of this story by the Daily Beast and other news organizations. And so it was kind of a last-ditch attempt for them to do this apparent extortion move against Jeff Bezos. The Washington Post wrote a story, I wrote a story earlier in the week, that spelled out the Bezos and the opposing theories of how the National Enquirer got these texts. So Bezos would have you believe through his investigator that this was politically motivated, that the brother of his mistress, Michael Sanchez, somehow got these texts from his sister and gave them to the National Enquirer, perhaps at the behest of Roger Stone and Carter Page and other people who are close to the president and are close friends as well of Michael Sanchez. The alternative view of this whole thing is the one that is put out there by Michael Sanchez, who invokes the deep state and the National Security Agency and so on, and thinks that this was some sort of a hacking that went on. So it's very complex, but the bottom line is that Jeff Bezos has extraordinarily embarrassing information out there, in part because of his own behavior, but in part because someone took private pictures and gave them to the National Enquirer, perhaps for political reasons.
So, Mark, there's an element of this that feels like a proxy war, as it were?
Well, that's certainly the Bezos theory of the case, that because of his ongoing tiff or battle with the president, President Trump has repeatedly taken Jeff Bezos to task, portraying him and the newspaper he owns, where I work, as having an animus against him. And so he has kind of conflated Amazon, The Washington Post, and Bezos, even though they're three separate entities, and led this campaign of disparagement against them. And so Bezos believes that that is the political motivation behind the National Enquirer doing this cover story, 12 pages, an extraordinary outburst of gossip reporting about someone they ordinarily don't talk about.
Renee writes, I could care less about naked photos of him being released. We are all human, and I'm pretty sure we're all still going to buy from Amazon. And Miriam writes, okay, that does it. I'm going to subscribe to the Washington Post. James Andel, what do you see this is about? I mean, if Jeff Bezos, who is one of the richest people in the world that we know of,
right,
cannot protect himself against these kinds of threats, against this kind of invasion of privacy, I wonder what that means for the average person. Granted, the National Enquirer doesn't have an equal incentive to go after every single person,
right,
but if they ain't scared to go after Jeff Bezos and they decide to go after you, game over, right?
Yeah, there's really nothing you can do about it. On the one hand, it shows you if people are getting in trouble for their yearbooks from the 1980s, all of the technology that we have now, where all of your embarrassing moments, all your compromising moments could really be preserved for perpetuity, your text messages, your photos, your social media presence, your life in many cases is much more documented now than it would be 20, 30 years ago. And so that's a problem from a privacy perspective. But also in a way, this is the perfect Trump-era scandal because you have an opponent of the president, an outspoken sort of combatant with the president, somebody who's a favorite Twitter target of the president, who's ensnared in this. The National Enquirer is close to Trump and close to people in Trump's orbit. But then you also have people talking about the deep state and surveillance. And those are major issues where Trump has argued that he has been on the wrong side of the deep state and has been improperly surveilled, or at least that his campaign was, and perhaps Trump Tower was.
The evidence for that remains to solidify.
But he's claimed it.
Right, he's claimed it.
I'm not saying that there's evidence for it. I'm saying he's claimed it. And so to have all of that out there in a story involving entirely private citizens is kind of an irony of our times.
Can we go back to the Virginia story, Jessica? There's one character in that story that I neglected to kind of ask a little bit more about, and that's Justin Fairfax, the lieutenant governor. We did get some comments about that. Mm-hmm. We are flooded with comments about the Virginia story. Clearly people have opinions and questions, including Pam, who is in Arlington, right across the Potomac from here. Pam writes, there was a report that Professor Tyson, the woman who made the accusations against Justin Fairfax, had contacted the Washington Post last year about Justin Fairfax when she learned he was running, but the Post decided not to run the story. Can someone on your panel clarify that? Either Jessica, Mark, do we know anything about that?
Mark could probably speak more
Mark
to that behind
sure.
the...
Yes, that's indeed what happened. The professor knew someone, had a friend at the Washington Post, and said, hey, I have this story. You want to look into it? And we did. Another reporter took some time and looked into it and found no one who could corroborate either story. No one who was there, no one who they had told about contemporaneously. And so lacking any other corroboration, it was a pure she said, he said situation. The Post decided not to report on the story at that time. And then the same blog that exposed Governor Northam and the photo in his yearbook came out earlier this week with the story of this professor without naming her. And the lieutenant governor reacted immediately by saying that the Post had cleared him, which was not the case. So that forced the Post to put out a story saying, no, we didn't clear him. We just didn't do the story because there was no corroboration. There is a difference.
Love to get a reaction to BJ from Cincinnati before we move on. BJ emailed, I'm concerned we're possibly throwing the baby out with the bathwater, shedding ourselves of beliefs that people of other colors, lifestyles, genders, etc. are lesser people, beliefs that were the culture of our childhood, takes an enormous amount of work. Perhaps we should use those who have done the work and come out the other side enlightened to teach us how to do that work. Removing them from leadership positions may deny us the teachers we need to move forward. Interesting comment from BJ, but I note that BJ refers to people who have done the work and come out the other side enlightened. And I don't think that Governor Northam or General Herring have yet to come out the other side of this at all. But I do take BJ's point that there is this energy among many people who are like, can we please forgive and reconcile and move on? How do we go forward from there?
Well, Ralph Northam would be the first to say that he has not come out the other side. And he would be the first to say that he comes from an environment. We have a bunch of reporters who are in the town where he grew up who the last few days who have been discovering just how deeply ingrained casual racism is in the small town where he grew up. And Ralph Northam is very frank about that. And so while he's not someone who's come out the other side, he's someone who has been grappling with these issues throughout his public life. And is there some benefit to have him do that in a very public way? He believes so. But clearly the entirety of his own party is lined up against that. And they believe that this is kind of a nuclear event and he needs to go.
James?
Well, the other question, too, is given that we are struggling as a society to say, where do we draw the line? What do we even consider racism to be? That is an open question. Does it require institutional power? Is it a form of animus? How do we define it? And if we can't draw the line at blackface, it's difficult to see where we would draw the line at that point. That seems like an obvious place where we could draw the line. I think that the other issue is that in a lot of these situations, when you have either an allegation of racism or an allegation of sexual misconduct, the Democrats have done better, I think, at policing their ranks on these issues recently than Republicans, and have seemed to move away from the idea that with Bill Clinton and Ted Kennedy, that if you're really on our side, we don't take these allegations very seriously. They're the work of cranks. But it's never really been tested in a situation where they were possibly going to lose power at the same time. So Al Franken, he's going to resign, but you're probably going to keep his Senate seat. John Conyers resigns. You're definitely going to keep his House seat. You have the trifecta of resignations here in Virginia. You are giving up power to the Republicans.
The next person in line is a conservative Republican.
Are you willing then to police your ranks in that context where you will be giving up political power?
And Jessica, briefly?
Well, and I think over the past year especially, racism seems to have been more of a red and blue issue after Charlottesville and different things, and President Trump and other Republican leaders were criticized for their response. But I think we're learning that this is not a Democrat-Republican problem, that this is something that was pervasive in the culture, a lot of times depending upon where you grew up in. The same way that I know I've said before on this program that I don't think sexual harassment is not a Republican or a Democratic problem. It's a problem. And I think that we are seeing that racism is across that. It has no partisan bounds.
One more comment on this before we move on. Ian tweeted, "It is naive to think that the current crisis in Virginia is limited to elected officials. This issue has forced us to look at yearbooks from across the state. Blackface was appearing in Virginia college yearbooks well into the 1990s. All right, plenty more we have to discuss. Let's move on and let's talk about the president and his plans for next week. On Monday, he is scheduled to have a rally in El Paso, Texas. That border city will be Trump's first rally of 2019. Certainly, we will be dealing with the specter of a potential national emergency or another shutdown regarding border security. And the way the president has discussed the wall has kind of changed over time. Here he is in a rally in 2015 answering a question from a young attendee.
What are the walls going to be made out of?
That might be the best question I get today. I'll tell you what it's going to be made of. It's going to be made of hardened concrete, and it's going to be made out of rebar and steel. And, you know, it's so easy. That's what I do.
Contrast what he said in 2015 with what he said in an exchange with a reporter this year.
As far as concrete, I said I was going to build a wall. I never said, I'm going to build the concrete. I said I'm going to build a wall.
You said concrete.
Just so you don't, because I know you're not into the construction business, you don't understand something. We now have a great steel business that's rebuilt in the United States. Steel is stronger than concrete. If I build this wall or fence or anything the Democrats need to call it, because I'm not into names, I'm into production. I'm into something that works. If I build a steel wall rather than a concrete wall, it will actually be stronger than a concrete. Steel is stronger than concrete.
So that's the president speaking this year. Now, to be clear, he said he never said that it would be concrete. That is not true, as you heard from the first clip. But with regards to the rally in El Paso, Jessica, Lynn writes, "He used my hometown of El Paso to bolster lies about border wall effectiveness. He called it previously one of the nation's highest crime cities, which is a lie. Then he said a wall suddenly fixed the crime, another lie. It was one of the nation's safest cities for many, many years before the extended wall. There's been some kind of fence, as in a chain link fence, for decades in the urban center." So this El Paso rally, Jessica, what's the significance of this event?
Well, I think he's making it there on the border. He has, you know, in his State of the Union this week, he singled out El Paso, and the listener there that responded is exactly right. Those claims were rife with falsehoods because, yes, there was a spike in El Paso in the 1990s in crime, but there was across the country, and it has been one of the safest cities and, you know, that and continues to be, and it's not attributable to that wall, independent fact checkers have found. And, you know, this is also setting up an interesting thing, too. I think Trump is clearly showing that he is making immigration the backbone of his reelection campaign. We're seeing all of these 2020 candidates announced. This is sort of feels like his unofficial kickoff, even though I'm not sure he ever really stopped running for reelection, certainly. But he's doubling down on this. He believes his wall. He believes talking about immigration and the dangers that it poses riles up his base. That he made that same gamble in 2018. It did not work. Democrats won back the House overwhelmingly with 17 more seats than they needed to flip the House. And Trump was out there holding these rallies, pushing this message. And so I think that's, you know, it's a dangerous one to do. And whether he can make this announcement about a national emergency or something is to be seen. But this is a tricky issue for him. And I think we also saw, you know, the prolonged shutdown did not work in Republicans' favor either.
David writes, as someone who grew up in El Paso, I was insulted by his comments in the State of the Union. El Paso has been the second safest city in the country, and I never felt unsafe in my many years there. Also, with regards to immigration, in a court filing at the end of last week, the Trump administration updated on the thousands of children separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border. According to the filing, Mark, even more children were separated than were originally believed, and reuniting them with their parents may not be, quote, within the realm of the possible, unquote. So what's next in all this? The government is basically saying, maybe we can't find their parents. Maybe we can. Where do we go from here?
Well, not only are they saying maybe we can't find the parents, they're saying even if we do find the parents, maybe we don't want to give those kids back. They're saying that it might be extraordinarily difficult to give the kids back. That it would take too much time on the part of the federal employees and contractors who would have to do that work. And they still don't know exactly how many kids are involved. There are thousands of them, but they have not been able to come up with a good number. It's an extraordinary situation, and it's one where they're kind of saying it's a bureaucratic difficulty to reunite children with their own parents. They say it would take up to 8 hours per case to do so, and therefore that's a hurdle that's simply too high.
Let's talk about the Supreme Court briefly. Yesterday, it blocked a Louisiana law that opponents say could have left the state with just one doctor in one clinic authorized to provide abortion services. It was a 5-4 vote, with Chief Justice John Roberts joining the court's 4-member liberal wing. James, this is something of a turnaround for Roberts in a way. He's voted to sustain other laws restricting abortion. What about this one?
Well, I think John Roberts is increasingly viewed, at least among conservatives, as sort of an institutionalist, as somebody who may be conservative but feels invested in preserving the Supreme Court's image as a nonpartisan, non-ideological body.
Oh, and I'm sorry, James. We should note that there is likely to be a challenge to the law on its merits next term, which starts in October. So this is not necessarily the end of the process.
It's not necessarily the end here. But it is another sign, and I think the ruling on the Affordable Care Act was the first real prominent example of this trend, where Roberts does seem to be a little reluctant to go as far as some of his other conservatives on the Supreme Court in terms of getting rid of liberal judicial precedents that have been established for some time. Many other conservatives who are working their way up through the federal judiciary argue that if, by their reading of the Constitution, a precedent is wrong, it should be overturned. And that is a school of thought that has become increasingly prevalent among judicial conservatives. Roberts is more of the judicial restraint school and has at times voted unpredictably in cases where there could have been a 5-4 split that went the conservatives' way.
With regards to Virginia, Tom writes, Joshua, why did no one mention that a Republican, State Senate Majority Leader Thomas K. Norment, is also involved in a blackface scandal? He was editor of the VMI yearbook, the Virginia Military Institute yearbook, in 1968 when it featured several photos of people in blackface and included a number of racial slurs, including one use of the N-word, according to the Washington Post. Why are you giving him a pass? Not giving him a pass, Tom. There's just so much blackface going around, it's hard to keep track. Let's talk about the 2020 presidential race. There were no big announcements this week, but there were some teases from former Texas Representative Beto O'Rourke and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar. O'Rourke sat down in front of an audience Tuesday with Oprah Winfrey, who asked him the big question, will he announce if he's running for president?
Have you given yourself a deadline? I'm serious about that. Have you given yourself a...
And the serious answer is really soon. It is really soon, before the end of this month. I'm sure many people here would like to know the answer from you.
Yeah.
Is this something you have considered doing? Would you?
The reason I respect your process is because I do firmly believe it's something you've got to feel inside of yourself.
Absolutely.
And you've got to come to a knowing inside yourself.
Those were Beto O'Rourke and Oprah Winfrey in conversation this week. Also, Senator Amy Klobuchar hinted at some big news with a tweet which read, quote, "I'm making a big announcement on Sunday," unquote. She'll be speaking in Minneapolis. This parlor game is getting a little old. I feel like there's almost too many characters in the story for me or any normal person who doesn't live and die by the Beltway to keep track. And also, it's going to make it more challenging to whittle down the field, Jessica, I think, for Democrats who are just looking for someone who they know can beat Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if we thought the Republican field in 2016 was big, welcome to the 2020 Democratic field. I'm not sure that, you know, they talked about having an undercard debate or something. I think feel like you're going to need three or people drawing straws. Who knows? So, yes, you know.
I love that idea of an undercard, like a boxing match.
Yeah.
Right.
Maybe we should have a March Madness tournament for the presidential candidates or something. But it really is, and there is this worry that with more candidates getting in that, you know, there is absolutely no clear frontrunner. There are people that have not telegraphed their decisions lately that I think are sort of the, you know, elephant in the room in a way. Joe Biden, I think, is probably one of the biggest ones left to drop what he's going to do. And Beto O'Rourke was interesting this week because he had all this momentum coming out of 2018 and he kind of faded a little bit because he was sort of off doing sort of this Kerouac thing. He wrote this post on Medium that was kind of strange. He isn't doing the traditional things that other candidates like Cory Booker and Kamala Harris were doing with lining up people in early state and making early states visits. But he sort of reemerged this week, I feel like.
One last musical story before we go, especially for those of you who are used to waking up this way. We learned this week that the theme to Morning Edition will change for the first time in decades. NPR has hired a company called Man-Made Music to do its audio branding. Some of the company's recent work includes the theme to CBS This Morning, the revised theme to NBC Nightly News, and HBO's feature presentation graphic. NPR CEO Jarl Mohn says the new theme will be inspired by the original, composed by BJ Lederman. Before we go, one more nominee for Record of the Year called Rockstar by Post Malone featuring 21 Savage, the aforementioned 21 Savage. The rest of the nominees, by the way, for Record of the Year are I Like It by Cardi B, Bad Bunny, and J Balvin, The Joke by Brandi Carlile, This Is America by Childish Gambino, Shallow by Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper from the soundtrack to A Star Is Born, and All the Stars by Kendrick Lamar and SZA from the soundtrack to Black Panther. James Antle, editor-in-chief of the American Conservative Magazine. James, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Mark Fisher, senior editor at the Washington Post. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
And NPR's lead digital political reporter, Jessica Taylor. Thanks, Jessica.
Thanks for having me.
Our lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Ben Privett and Josephine Neonai. Our digital staff is Gabrielle Healy and Catherine Fink. We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Babbel. Have you always wanted to speak a new language? Whether it's for travel, work, or brain training, Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons will get you speaking confidently in your new language. Choose from Spanish, French, and more. You'll learn through real-life dialogues, speech recognition, and interactive trainers. And Babbel's spaced repetition method actually makes you remember what you've learned. Download the app or go to Babbel, Babbel.com, to try Babbel for free.
The categories of left and right divide our world.
Exit left.
All the left-handed people.
Left-wing extremism.
A right-wing group.
Far right.
Exit right.
These categories also apply to our brains. How the left and right hemispheres shape our view of the world. This week on Hidden Brain.
This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. It's a new year, the year of the pig under the lunar calendar, but many of the same problems are following us as the calendar turns. Brexit remains a debacle, with a top European official mincing no words on just how bad it's gotten. Venezuela remains in turmoil, putting more attention on its neighboring countries. And climate change remains a global crisis, though now we have an even clearer picture of how critical it is. Plenty to make sense of this week on the Friday News Roundup. And joining us in studio to answer your questions is Peter Bergen, Vice President and Director of the International Security Program at New America. He's also a national security analyst for CNN and the author of United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. Peter, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thank you, Josh.
Also with us new to the Roundup is Dorothy Parvaz, the global politics reporter for Think Progress. Dorothy, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And we welcome back Shane Harris, the intelligence and national security reporter for The Washington Post. He's also a Future of War fellow at New America and the author of At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. Shane, glad to have you back.
Thanks, Joshua.
We begin in Venezuela. More than 40 countries, 40 countries, have now declared support for Venezuela's interim president, Juan Guaido. They include France, Spain, Germany, and as of this morning, Romania. But an attempt by the United States Agency for International Development to deliver $60 million in humanitarian aid was stopped at the border between Venezuela and Colombia. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro refused the aid, stating, quote, "We are not a country of beggars," unquote. Before we get to the humanitarian part, Shane Harris, let's start with the growing support for Juan Guaido. We spoke earlier in previous roundups about how the United States had come out in support of Guaido, and now there is this power vacuum in terms of the President Maduro, who won in this highly contested election, and Guaido, who's got the support of the opposition. Is it looking more or less likely that Maduro can hang on?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, he's hanging on in part by resisting the aid and also insisting that the United States is somehow trying to overthrow him and that there's essentially a Western-led plot to undermine him and take him out. So he's trying to rally popular support in that way. But from an international perspective, I think it's like the tide has already turned against him. There are now 47 countries. I mean, you know, the United Kingdom, Theresa May came out and said sanctions are still very much something that's on the table here. So there is really no, aside from, I think, you know, Russia and Cuba, kind of being some of the big powers, or if we can call them that, that are siding with him, most countries have turned against him. So in the international space, he has basically no support, and people are calling on him to have a free and open and fair and credible election, which is, of course, what did not happen before.
Although I understand, Shane, there's still a few countries that are kind of staying out of it. I think Italy and Ireland have withheld support. They haven't said one way or the other, right?
Right, but you've got, you know, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, the United States. I mean, these are really the big countries sort of on the international stage that matter and have the most clout. And I think that sentiment has clearly turned against Maduro.
Now, Peter, Maduro has been warning Washington about considering plans to intervene. It said that it will have blood on its hands if it does. I wonder if this is an idle threat or if there actually might be some bloodshed, considering that Maduro still mostly has the support of Venezuela's military.
Well, and that's the key thing. I mean, if he loses their support, then he's, you know, it's in a different situation. But, you know, the history of American military interventions in Latin America is not a super appealing set of interventions. Certainly, you know, we saw the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, with a kind of interesting notation about 5,000 troops to Colombia on one of his pads that a sharp-eyed journalist picked up. Now, what that means, I'm not quite sure. To me, it's very interesting that Elliot Abrams has been appointed special envoy to Venezuela, because Abrams is one of the people that was Tillerson, Secretary of State Tillerson, really wanted to be his top deputy. But because he'd written an anti-Trump article during the campaign, he couldn't be considered. The interesting thing about these special envoy roles is they don't need Senate confirmation. But here you have a very senior American diplomat who's been charged with kind of sorting this out. And I imagine that, you know, the roll call of countries that Shane just mentioned, I think is, you know, it shows that Abrams is, you know, being quite successful creating this kind of coalition that is against Maduro. But I think it's all moot. I don't think we're going to invade. And as long as he has the support of the military, I mean, basically he's in charge of the country.
It would seem also, Peter, I don't know if it's unlikely. I wonder what you think about whether it's unlikely, partly because Venezuela still has so much oil under the ground, and there are business interests that would like to be able to get into a peaceful Venezuela once all of this gets settled, to do business there. And if there's a military intervention, then that blows everything into chaos, potentially.
Yeah, and also Trump, of course, you know, came into office on a sort of ticket that we weren't going to do these kinds of interventions.
Yeah.
So, and there's no demand signal from the American public, as far as I can tell, for us to go in and enforce to this country.
Dorothy Parvaz, how do you see it?
Well, I mean, when we talk about Venezuela being an oil-rich country, it's also, you know, there's already international interest present there. China has some investments there and is not about to sit by and just watch, you know, this all go to hell in a handbag. But I mean, you know, when Maduro says we're not a country of beggars, we're not going to accept aid, it's not so much, I don't think, that he doesn't believe that there's a need in his country, but this aid is coming from the U.S. and it comes with strings attached. You know, as Peter pointed out, this is the U.S. has a really terrible history of military interventions, not just in Latin America, but everywhere in the world. It's never really worked out that well.
Dorothy, let me stick with you as it relates to getting aid into the country. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke on that this week. Here is part of what he told the Fox Business Network on Wednesday.
Today, we tried to deliver humanitarian assistance from Colombia, from the United States and Colombia, into Venezuela. And the Venezuelan military, under the direction of Mr. Maduro, stopped that. Not only is he not allowing the economy to flourish, he is actively denying medicine and foodstuffs and hygiene kits for his own people. This is horrific stuff. And I think the Venezuelan people have had enough of it, and I'm confident that in the days and weeks ahead, they will continue to protest, continue to rise up.
That's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking Wednesday on the Fox Business Network. So, Dorothy, what about that? This idea that the people will continue to protest, continue to rise up, perhaps that the aid that they're being denied will fuel the opposition even further?
Well, there's two ways to look at this. First of all, if we look at from the context of Venezuela, sure. I mean, this might start turning the tide within the country where there is a need, and it might start putting pressure on the military to sort of step away from supporting Maduro, and that will really be the beginning of the end. Then we might see Maduro in exile in Cuba. We might see an election. But I think there's also the perspective of how little credibility the U.S. has when you see Secretary Pompeo saying, gosh, you know, Mr. Maduro, that he doesn't refer to him as President Maduro, Mr. Maduro is denying crucial aid. You know, this is, the U.S. is supporting Saudi Arabia in its war in Yemen, where the Saudi government has prevented very crucial humanitarian aid from reaching millions of Yemeni people. And we've seen millions of people facing hardships, hundreds of thousands starving to death and children. So when we talk about, you know, the importance of humanitarian aid reaching a place, the U.S. as a government just right now lacks credibility in acting like an agent that really cares about these things.
Gloria wrote on our Facebook page, "We sat on our thumbs with Nicaragua. Why such a big deal now with Venezuela?" And Molly wrote on our Facebook page, "Latin America is all over the news recently, but no one is talking about Nicaragua. Hundreds have been killed by Ortega's mercenaries, many more missing or have fled into exile." Shane Harris, interesting points. I think it is more accurate to say that Latin America is all over the English language news recently. I think if you look at, you know, Univision and Telemundo, which have formidable audiences of their own, it's not like this isn't being covered. It just kind of depends on where you look. These stories have been on NPR too. But I do take their point. Like, why now? Why is this an issue all of a sudden?
Well, it's interesting. We could actually go back to the 1980s, and we did quite a lot of things in Nicaragua, but that was a different time. But I think that what's happening now, and one way that we might look at this is, President Trump, despite his affinity for strongmen and autocrats, I mean, has always sort of positioned Maduro as an adversary. And there's obviously tremendous oil wealth in Venezuela. The United States would like to see that country open and more friendly to Western companies, certainly international oil companies. The infrastructure was nationalized under Hugo Chavez, so that has been a long time that a lot of oil companies in this country have not been able to be in there. But I think this is also an opportunity for the Trump administration to just sort of isolate Maduro, which is something that they would like to be able to do, and point out that the humanitarian aspects of this, I mean, as we were saying earlier, that kind of is a little bit discordant given what we're doing in Yemen. But this is a regime that they have just pointed to as socialist, as, you know, leftist, and one that they would like to try and isolate. So it's that opportunity.
Let's wrap up with Venezuela. Dorothy, there was a point you wanted to make.
Right. So I thought the listener made an excellent point about why is this such a big deal to us? Why is Venezuela big deal to us. And part of it is that, you know, our adversaries, our challengers, however you want to see them, Russia, China, and Cuba, all have big roles in this country. So if we sort of don't intervene, well, you know, that's the thinking of the administration anyway, and don't try to exert some sort of control or influence, the thinking is, well, that's an area that we lose control of, right? So Russia, China, Cuba, their positions are strengthened in the region.
Now, in a press conference this week, Pope Francis offered to intervene in this conflict if both leaders agree to his involvement. Peter Bergen, does that seem likely? Might it make a difference? Is that just the thing you do out of sympathy? Like, hey, man, I don't know what to do, but if I could help, just you know how to find me. Like, what is this?
I don't know, to be honest, Josh. I'm a big fan of Pope Francis on a lot of levels, but clearly he has much bigger fish to fry than simply Venezuela. And, the Catholic Church is probably in the biggest crisis since the Reformation. The Reformation was quite some time ago. But clearly this is an almost existential problem for the church in the United States in particular, I think. But in a lot of other European countries, whether you look at Ireland or Britain or pick your country, and one of the topics that we were going to discuss is also this question of abuse of nuns. And, there are cases in India, there are cases in around the world of this issue. That seems like that's the thing that should be in his inbox.
Yeah, before we get to that Catholic Church scandal, we will get to that. Let me get to a few more comments on Venezuela. John writes, every time the United States tries to intervene on behalf of oppressed people, it doesn't always go well. I think we should stop intervening. We should just stick with our allies. Scott writes, I understand why the U.S. would want to get involved in a situation like this, but of all the wrongdoings that go on around the world every year, how does the U.S. decide which ones to stand up against? There are many things we should have stood up for around the world, but did not. Shane, I think that's an excellent question. The stakes for the United States, it's not like Venezuela has an army that we're worried about, rushing our borders. The concerns about a migrant caravan don't extend as far down as Venezuela. What is it? What's in it for the U.S. in being involved in this?
Well, I think you could actually make a moral argument on this one. I mean, you're talking about a country that should be enjoying tremendous wealth and prosperity, given the oil that it has in the ground, in which inflation has reached almost unimaginable levels, and people literally cannot afford to buy the basic things they need to stay alive. So there is a humanitarian crisis that is there that I think is largely the function of probably of government mismanagement and some other functions as well. So there is that humanitarian argument. We've talked about the geopolitical strategic interest as well, and making sure that countries like China don't come in and become the big kid on the block. We would like to avoid that as well. I don't know, though, that this administration has really articulated very well what is the interest. The fact that so many people are writing in and saying, wait, why are we worried about Venezuela? What's going on there? I think tells you that for as agitated as Secretary Pompeo gets and likes to poke Nicolas Maduro, this administration really hasn't come out and explained to the American people, why do we care?
Let's move on from Venezuela and talk about El Salvador. Nayib Bukele has been elected as El Salvador's new president. He's 37 years old, the former mayor of San Salvador, and he is the youngest president-elect there. He's also the first Muslim to be the president of El Salvador. Now, Dorothy, this election breaks a lot of historical ground. What's the other historical significance of this, other than just the fact that this guy is so unique?
Well, I mean, I think you pointed out the fact that this his background is completely different than anybody else. But it's also a break for the country in that he comes without the baggage of being so entrenched in a very corrupt and criminal sort of political system, right? What I'm worried about is that now the Trump administration will start classifying this country as a Muslim country, and all the migrants coming from there will be classified as Muslim terrorists, frankly.
El Salvador is one of those countries in the Northern Triangle from which some of the migrant caravans were coming. But to the point that you made about the political establishment, he also does not come from these two big political parties, the Arena Party, which is on the far right, and the FMLN, which is on the far left. So, Dorothy, I guess the hope is that he can help El Salvador turn the page.
Well, that is definitely the case. I mean, he's the candidate of hope, I guess, is how people see it. Then that's how he's where he's at. But he's too inexperienced and too young right now for people to really know what he's going to be able to deliver. I mean, one of the key things he delivered was like beautifying San Salvador, making it pretty. Well, that's great, but you have drug cartels all over the place. You have mass crime. You have a lot of corruption. So you're going to need a lot more than cosmetic changes. So hopefully he will be able to deliver what people want.
That's kind of what I was wondering also, Peter. I don't know if this is a fair comparison. Correct me if it's not. But as I hear his story, I think about a guy like Emmanuel Macron, right? He's outside of the political establishment in France, kind of center left, comes from the world of business, has a little bit of appeal for a number of people, stands in opposition to someone like Marine Le Pen, who people were very afraid of having become the president of France. Then he wins office, very hopeful campaign. And then people start to get to know him and they're like, maybe we don't like you as much as we think. It's almost the risk of being an idealistic outsider once the reality of politics and government set in.
Yeah, and I mean, France has problems, but it doesn't have problems on the scale that Dorothy referred to.
No.
I mean, Salvador is one of the most dangerous countries in the world. The reason these caravans are gathering is because people are desperate to leave. So, look, I mean, if he was a kind of combination of, you know, Winston Churchill and Mahatma Gandhi, I mean, you know, the problems are not he's bound to disappoint, right? Because the problems are too big. I mean, this is not something. Salvador's been in crisis now for several decades, and the problems seem to have got worse.
I'm still picturing if Winston Churchill and Mahatma Gandhi had it. That's too. I'm going to move on from that. Shane, I'm going to try to move on from that anyway. That image is too damn compelling. Is there anyone in this guy's corner? I mean, he's an outsider. Who's vouching for him? Who's pushing for him to succeed?
Well, he had 53% of the vote. So, I mean, obviously the people of El Salvador are pushing for him, and there was a repudiation of the traditional sort of two-party left-right system. Interesting, you know, he appeared on the night of the election with the former attorney general of Guatemala, who was famous for prosecuting the president and vice president back in 2015, which led to their ouster. So I suppose you could say who's backing him is sort of the idea of a reformist movement in Latin America, that people who want to see a break with the system. I mean, he is very much, he's like a political brand, right? He shows up in jeans and a leather jacket. He is very self-stylized in that sense. So, I mean, I think he's really kind of riding that, you know, we call it the populist wave if you want, although that's a little bit reductive. But clearly, I mean, the majority of people in his country are rooting for him.
Different kind of populism than what we see, say, in parts of Europe.
Sure.
Very serious story this week as it relates to the continuing scandal over abuse in the Catholic Church. Pope Francis has had to deal with that very directly. He was the first pontiff ever to visit the Arabian Peninsula, the birthplace of Islam. He delivered mass to a crowd of roughly 140,000 people in Abu Dhabi, including 4,000 Muslims. On the flight back to Rome, the Pope made more headlines by publicly acknowledging, for the very first time, the sexual abuse that was suffered by nuns at the hands of priests and bishops. The Pope acknowledged the abuse and said the church has been working on it, in his words, for some time. Dorothy Parvaz, what was the impact of him making this disclosure?
I think it actually angered people more because initially this was described as a form of sexual slavery what the nuns had to go through. And he tried to soften that language and said, no, it was more of they were being pressured. It was an abuse of power. And he said, well, you know, not everybody did this. Well, gosh, great. What? I mean, are we just talking about massive sexual harassment and rape and sexual assault, but done by 10% of the clergy, 5%, 2%, what percent is acceptable? The softening of the language was just really shocking and I think further inflamed people.
Peter, there's also this meeting coming up in 2 weeks with bishops to deal with child sex abuse by the clergy. These meetings have been controversial in the past because, correct me if my memory's off, but the Pope has exerted pressure on other efforts around the church to try to take action on this. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops tried to address it during their meeting, and right before the meeting was about, like, seconds before the meeting was going to start, they get word from the Vatican saying, no, hold on, we're going to deal with this in February. So it seems like there's a lot of pressure, there's a lot of attention that's going to be paid to this meeting to see what the Pope actually does, as opposed to just what the church says.
Yeah, I agreed. And when Pope Francis sort of took office, I think there was tremendous hope in the Catholic Church because he seemed to be quite a different pontiff than we've had in the past, and more willing to kind of grapple with the issues that have bedeviled the Catholic Church, and more really talking the message of Christ rather than just the sort of typical paper. That said, I think that he's being very slow on this sexual, the question of the sexual crimes of people in the church. So we'll see. I mean, you know, on the other hand, you know, you mentioned this going to the Emirates and celebrating Mass. It's a big deal. I mean, it says something about the Emiratis that they would allow this, and it says something about him that he did it. But still, it's a minor thing compared to this really enormous crisis of faith in the church because of the sexual activities of so many of the people who work in the church.
Shane, is there any sense of what the Pope might actually do? What kinds of actions he might take? That's been a little opaque for me through all this.
Yeah, and it's been fuzzy. I mean, he's obviously nodded towards it. He's acknowledged it, which I think everyone would agree is, okay, first step in forming some kind of a remedy. But it's not clear from what he said what that solution would be. And I mean, I think where his focus has been on trying to, you know, bring more people into the faith. I mean, there's this obvious problem with people leaving the church, and the Pope has become a global symbol of unity and understanding, and that's great for the message. But in terms of getting his own house in order, I mean, Peter used the right word. These are crimes. This is pervasive criminal activity that has spanned multiple continents over many decades, and it is something that he is very well aware of, having been a senior person in the church before he became the Pope. So he's not only having to deal with the public image of that, but also the fact that he knows very well what these problems are internally. And so I think if he's going to maintain this enormous credibility that he's had as the leader of the church and this goodwill, he's going to have to start putting some specifics on this.
Well, did you see the State of the Union address? One of the things you might have noticed that was not mentioned in President Trump's speech was climate change, even though NASA just announced that 2018 was the fourth warmest year on record. According to NASA, 18 of the 19 warmest years have occurred since the year 2000. The four warmest have basically been among the four most recent years. NASA and climate scientists at NOAA have said that even though last year was a little cooler than the three previous years, that is mostly due to random weather variations. And scientists warn that urgent action must be taken to reduce emissions. Dorothy Parvaz, these reports continue to come out from NASA, from NOAA, from federal climate scientists. I guess the question is when this becomes policy. There seems to be a little more energy toward making it policy, though not from the White House.
Oh, I think it'll become policy in this White House on the 12th of never. This is a president who spent most of his speech talking about the wall as a real national security threat, when even our own defense analysts and experts have said for years that climate change presents a major hole in our security and needs to be addressed. That is a national security threat. Running out of water is a national security threat.
There was also a disturbing report out of Asia this week, an intergovernmental organization based in Nepal that works with hundreds of scientists released a report. It said that a third or more of the glaciers of the Himalayas could be gone by the year 2100. Peter Bergen, can you give us a sense of how the rest of the world is dealing with some of this data, this increasingly clear picture of what climate change will look like and what it means for them if nothing's done?
Well, it's interesting. Countries like China, there's no denialism of climate change in so many countries around the world. And, you know, I think when historians write about Trump, they will say that Trump fiddled while the world burned. And that basically, even if you accept, let's say you people listening to this program think that climate change isn't caused by human activity. Even if you accepted that, you could still say this is something that is happening. We need to deal with, because there's a whole set of, the president did talk about infrastructure briefly in his speech. And so one of the big infrastructure projects is making cities like Miami like resilient to the fact that in 2050, good chunks of that city will be underwater. And, you know, a lot of cities are actually, Miami is well aware of this problem, at least certain elements of it. So it just seems that there is an opportunity here that even if you don't accept the scientific massive consensus that human activity is causing this, that we need to prepare for this, whatever your views on that issue, because it's coming.
And beyond that, Shane, this is also a matter of national security. You've heard some members of the military establishment, the intelligence community speak very, I don't even know what the right word is, very passionately, very urgently about the fact. Alarmingly, that's the right word, that climate change is literally a national security crisis.
Absolutely. I mean, this has been the case for years now. Every year, we just had one recently, there's this thing called the Worldwide Threats Briefing that the intelligence chiefs go up to Capitol Hill and say, basically, these are the 10 things keeping us all awake at night. Climate change has been on that list for a number of years because when sources of water dry up, as they might in this area of the Himalayas, these glaciers, people die. They fight. They dislocate. There's mass migration. There's movements. I mean, this is, we're talking about sort of the basic sort of fundamental elements of human security, quite literally evaporating. That's a national security problem, and it's something that has been not just this administration, but previous ones have been warning about, and you just haven't seen any action on it.
More of the roundup in a moment. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
Sam Sanders here. Every week on my show, It's Been a Minute, two journalists and I reflect on the news and culture of the week. Because when the news is this complicated, it really helps to just talk it out. Catch up with us on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Back now to the Friday News Roundup with Peter Bergen, Dorothy Parvaz, and Shane Harris. Dorothy, there was a point you wanted to make with regards to climate change. Go ahead.
Right. I mean, one of the hallmarks of this administration is how short-sighted it is. So basically, the president only cares about his next poll, sort of how, to see how he's doing, the next tweet, the next election cycle. He's not that concerned about what's going to happen to this planet in 3 years, 2 years, or even in 6 months.
He's also been very vocal about his skepticism on the causes of climate change, which we are not debating on this program. The evidence is overwhelming, so we are not going to debate that human actions are the primary cause of climate change. If you want to debate that, you're listening to the wrong show. But Peter, it's also important to note that there are a lot of companies around the world that are very clear that they want to be engaged in this. I mean, there is, to just be crass, there's a fortune to be made in dealing with climate change.
Well, I'll tell you, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is going to make big investments in solar energy. I mean, so
Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of all places.
A lot of oil there.
Right, a lot of oil there, but then also a lot of business to be done.
Moving away from that, absolutely. I mean, the company that comes, this is why major energy companies are investing in alternative energy, because there's a fortune to be made in it. And by the way, they all agree that humans cause climate change, and they understand their product is a major contributor to that.
I will say, by the way, we are settled on this program that human actions do cause climate change. But we've also had some discussions about how you discuss climate change, because it's thorny when you just try to talk about it. Can we back up to the Catholic Church story for 1 second? Because Patricia in Chicago brought up a worthwhile point that I think is worth picking apart just slightly. Patricia writes, what should the Pope do? Call law enforcement now. I think, Dorothy, that gets sticky depending on where in the world you are. We've spoken to some Catholic priests who say their new guidance from their bishops and archbishops is, if you find out about something that's happened, call law enforcement immediately. You don't even have to tell us first. Call law enforcement. But depending on where you are around the world, building that consensus, I feel like there's a challenge there.
And isn't that messed up that you need that kind of some kind of consensus to say that sexual assault is wrong?
Yeah. Well, and then there's law. Shane, there's law enforcement, and then there's law enforcement, and then there's law enforcement.
Well, I mean, look, I mean, these are crimes. I mean, we said this before. I mean, when they've happened in the United States, I mean, priests have gone to jail and been prosecuted for this. There's obviously a system and a culture within the Catholic Church that protects people in societies. We can go back to, you know, the clergy abuse scandal in Boston that was told in the movie Spotlight, if you want to get a sense of how deep sometimes communities protect themselves. But it's important to remember, I mean, these members of the clergy, they're not above the law. I mean, when they commit crimes in a jurisdiction, they can be prosecuted. And while the Vatican or the Holy See, you know, is a sovereign nation, the Catholic Church is not. It's not the same thing. And so we have to be very clear about the jurisdictional lines and boundaries here. I don't know why, I mean, to echo what Dorothy said, why it should be controversial if a priest in Washington, D.C. finds that, you know, another priest is sexually abusing children, why would you not call the police?
Dorothy?
Well, I mean, I suppose with the, you know, the issue might be that in some countries, what constitutes rape or who can be protected or prosecuted are different. But I mean, I think that the church can definitely call back their clergy, people who have committed these crimes, to a jurisdiction where they can be held accountable. They don't have to be prosecuted necessarily locally.
Let's talk a bit about Brexit. Donald Tusk is the president of the European Council, and he did not mince words when telling reporters how he felt about a no-plan Brexit.
By the way, I've been wondering what that special place in hell looks like for those who promoted Brexit without even a sketch of a plan how to carry it safely.
A special place in hell. Those are the words of European Council President Donald Tusk. Those comments came after a meeting between President Tusk and the Prime Minister of Ireland, Leo Varadkar, who was caught on a hot mic afterwards telling Mr. Tusk, quote, "They'll give you terrible trouble in the British press for that," unquote. Peter Bergen, did they give him terrible trouble?
I mean, he got criticized, but, you know, the definition of a gaffe in Washington is telling the truth in public. This is, I think, telling the truth in public. You know, the pound has lost 20% of its value since the vote in June 2016. And I think the markets are a pretty good kind of way of judging, like, if this is a good deal for the British economy and public. And the markets are speaking, and if there is a hard Brexit, so-called, on March 29th, if they don't get a deal together, the pound is going to drop a lot further.
How far along are we, Shane, in terms of trying to get a deal together? There had been a previous vote on a plan, didn't go far. Theresa May's been trying to work something out. That hasn't gone well. The possibility that the European Union might just have to rip away from the UK and figure it out as they go along seems real. And it's understandable why Ireland is concerned, because the border between Ireland and Northern Ireland would be a gigantic problem if there's no deal. How close or far are we from a deal?
Well, I think the question of the predicting is dangerous in this, and throughout the debate over the Brexit, you've even heard, you know, the smartest commentators in Great Britain saying we do not know what is going to happen. And I think that is genuinely an answer here. But it is looking more likely as the deadline approaches and there is no deal that you're going to have a hard Brexit. And what you're seeing with Tusk in that comment there is the frustration that the EU has, I think, with the way that the British government has been approaching this and sending the message, like, do not expect us to bail you out here. We offered you a deal. Your prime minister took it back. You don't want that deal. We're done. We're done making deals. And Theresa May has said that as well. So it's, you know, I don't want to predict, but it's looking increasingly likely that the hard Brexit is going to be the reality.
And I think, Dorothy, that's important to clarify for folks who may not be following this granularly exactly why Donald Tusk is so important in this. He's kind of, for lack of a better way to describe it, he's kind of the voice of Europe in a way, in terms of the UK's negotiation and trying to come up with something that the EU member states will sign off on.
Well, correct. And the thing is, they've already negotiated this deal with the EU member states. So the EU didn't want the UK to leave. They decided they're going to do it for some, I have no idea how that passed, why the voters really voted for it, but they did. And so, you know, the deal's been hammered out, and having Theresa May keep going back to try and get a different deal is just a non-starter. I wouldn't be surprised, actually, if they went for a second vote, like put it basically before the voters again. But, of course, this would be terribly embarrassing for the government, because they're basically saying, yeah, we gave you this thing to vote on. We had no way of delivering it, and we can't deliver it. So although we're calling this a vote, please vote no, because the yes isn't going to work out.
Right. What some people, I think, have been revoting Brexit, what some people have been calling a regrexit vote. But I also kind of am taken, Peter, by the fact that Donald Tusk said this out loud. Like, it sounds like he's just kind of let his id out for what a lot of people have been thinking, and he's reached a point where he's tired of being diplomatic about this.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if there's a unintended consequence of all this, which is that other countries have been talking at some point about leaving the EU, or, you know, there's a lot of frustration about Brussels micromanaging economies and that kind of thing. But I think that the Brexit experience in Britain, if any country who looks at that will say, actually, we're better in than out.
Well, we will not speculate on what's going to happen with Brexit. I think one week we had a soundbite from a British reporter. They asked him, you know, what can you tell us about where the negotiate and what's going to happen? And the soundbite was basically him going, look, I have no... it was basically the entire soundbite, so nobody knows where that's going to go. One thing in the world economy that seems a little bit clearer is who the new president of the World Bank might be. President Trump announced his pick for the World Bank president. It's a guy named David Malpass. He's an alumnus of the George H.W. Bush administration and the Reagan administration. Convention dictates that the U.S. gets to choose who runs the World Bank. Shane, I'd like your take on David Malpass, particularly because he has been openly critical of the World Bank in the past, and now it looks like he might get to be the guy in charge.
Right. Usually you don't pick somebody who has said that the institution is, you know, rife with problems to then go run it. He had a quote in to a House subcommittee in 2017, which kind of captures the sentiment and also helps understand why he's so appealing to President Trump, where he said, "Globalism and multilateralism have gone substantially too far to the point that they are hurting U.S. and global growth." That's very much a neat encapsulation of how Donald Trump views the world, views free trade, how he's approached, you know, deals with China, et cetera. So in that sense, Malpass is right there on the same page with him. And so he would bring a very different kind of operating principle to the bank, which is there principally to give loans to developing nations and to, you know, kind of extend the wealth that way. Somebody who is just a fundamental skeptic of the whole proposition on which the bank is based. So that it really is out of the norm, but sounds just right to President Trump, I think.
But can we take a step back, though, Shane? I hear you. I mean, there are plenty of people in the administration who are definitely contrarians to the mainstream of how those jobs are done. You know, you have Betsy DeVos as the Secretary of Education, who's very much in favor of charter schools and private education. You have Rick Perry, the Secretary of Energy, who did not have a clear picture of what the Energy Department did before he got the job. You have John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, who is very much a hawk. But is it just the Trump administration, or does the U.S. have longer kind of legacy drama with the World Bank? Is this a U.S. thing? Is this a Trump administration thing?
Well, there's certainly, I mean, it's not necessarily been a completely smooth relationship with the World Bank. And we should emphasize, too, it's not that, you know, Malpass is uninitiated in the ways of the global economy. I mean, he understands how things work. It's not like they appointed a neophyte for the position. It's just that I think he takes a view that is very much at odds, perhaps, with what the bank's sort of raison d'etre would be, and is very much in line with this, you know, isolationist proposition that President Trump has been putting forward. And that's not, by the way, something that, I mean, most presidents in the past have been pro-globalization, pro-free trade, pro-developing world loans. You haven't seen somebody sort of fundamentally hostile to the mission of the World Bank quite like this.
President Trump made a speech to the State Department this week about the future of the fight against the Islamic State, which continues to hold territory in Afghanistan, Libya, the Sinai, and West Africa. Here's part of what the president said.
It should be formally announced sometime, probably next week, that we will have 100% of the caliphate.
It's part of the president's address to the State Department this week. He added that only remnants of the caliphate still remain, but that, in his words, quote, remnants can be very dangerous, unquote. Dorothy, what does that mean? When he says 100% of the caliphate, what is he referring to? Territory, fighters, you know, the ideology? What's he talking about?
Well, if he's referring to fighters, then he's contradicting the Pentagon's own report that there are roughly 30,000 ISIS members remaining in the Levant region and are basically waiting to find a way to sort of reemerge as either with a different name or under a different flag. So I'm guessing he's talking about territory, but even that's not 100% correct.
And there's also, Peter, the president has come under fire for announcing the troop withdrawal from Syria. Is that still happening? That's still in the works, right?
Yeah, it's got to be finished by April now is the the latest on that. And then also there's this strange thing about the withdrawal from Afghanistan, which is sort of out there in the atmosphere, but it's not really clear if a formal order has been given, and sort of it tends to undercut. If the Taliban's principal goal is getting rid of American troops and you say preemptively we're going to take American troops out, seems like you're losing a lot of leverage at the negotiating table. And by the way, Joshua, as you recall, one of the principal arguments of Trump on the campaign trail is Obama kept making mistakes by signaling military moves, potential withdrawals, and this is basically exactly the same thing. So it's very puzzling to me why he does this.
Just to clarify with regards to what you're saying on Afghanistan, you're talking about these negotiations between the U.S. and elements of the Taliban that might allow for some kind of peace deal and kind of a new way forward between the Taliban and the Afghan government.
Yeah, but even as that process is happening, we're hearing these reports of maybe that half the American troops will be pulled out or some number. It's a little unclear, but it seems like a strange thing to put out there when you're having a negotiation on precisely this topic and you're just giving away this principal demand that they have without getting anything in return.
Another interview the president gave, for those of you who watched some of the run-up to the Super Bowl, in the interview that he gave to Margaret Brennan on CBS, President Trump declared his intention to keep U.S. troops in Iraq so that they can monitor Iran. Iraqi President Barham Saleh later rejected this plan, stating, quote, Iraq does not want to be a party or axis to any conflict between multiple countries, unquote. Shane Harris, what about this? What might this mean for the U.S. relationship with Iraq? I mean, can the U.S. do this if the Iraqi government doesn't want it?
Well, we should remind people that Iraq and Iran have a history, a very contentious one.
Very.
Obviously. And so, you know, the president really, I think, this is an example here where he maybe didn't read the briefing before he, you know, sort of stepped in it and sort of making policy on the fly. I mean, ultimately, look, if the government of Iraq says we're not going to allow your soldiers to be based here, or we're not going to agree to the terms, they can't be based there. But what the president is saying, I think he's trying to suggest that somehow they're there for some kind of like reconnaissance mission or just to keep an eye on Iran. There's lots of ways the U.S. intelligence community keeps an eye on Iran that don't involve thousands of troops being positioned in Iraq. And I think the government of Iraq hears that and says, whoa, whoa, hold on a second. You're proposing, it sounds to us, like using us as a base for you to go attack Iran. And that's a non-starter for them.
Dorothy?
Well, I mean, first of all, the base is on the wrong side of the country to watch Iran. It's closer to the border with Syria. And, you know, while it's true that Iran and Iraq do have a contentious history that was a very long war, they also have a relationship that is workable and has to be because they are neighbors. As the Iraqi president pointed out, we live here. Right. So Iran lives there. Iraq lives there. They need to get along. And Iraq is very much aware, and the president should be as well, President Trump, that is, that without the support of Iran, the Hashd al-Shaabi, the Shia militia, you know, would not have been able to fight ISIS as effectively as they did, the Iraqis did.
Dorothy Parvaz, global politics reporter for Think Progress. Dorothy, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
Peter Bergen, vice president and director of the International Security Program at New America, also national security analyst for CNN, and author of United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
And Shane Harris, future of war fellow at New America, intelligence and national security reporter for The Washington Post, and the author of The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. Thanks, Shane.
Thanks, Joshua.
1A senior team is Lindsay Foster Thomas, Danielle Knight, Gabe Bullard, and Denise Couture. This episode was edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your weekend. We'll see you Monday from St. Petersburg, Florida. This is 1A.